Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mountain Bikes Apart podcast. This is the show about everything mountain biking, from equipment to trail guides and everything in between. I'm Colin Gray and, as always, joined by Tom Bell. How are you doing, Tom?
Hi, Colin. Yeah, good to speak to you.
Yeah, you too. It feels like it's been a while.
Yeah, it has. I think we spoke last episode of the podcast was about a month ago, time for a bit of a catch-up and talk about mountain bikes.
Yes, and apologies to everyone out there if you've been waiting for this episode. Hoping to get back into a regular schedule for the summer season, actually. We might come up with another themed season coming up soon, but the next two episodes, I think, will be a catch-up just between Tom and myself, maybe plans for this year, what's been happening at the start of this year, and a couple of listener questions. We've got some good stuff, actually, in from a few different listeners, so looking forward to covering them as well. Let's start with what you've been up to, Tom. What's been happening in the last week? Well, here you've been off to a race in Portugal, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the first race of the season was a UCI ranked stage race in the Algarve, mm-hmm. Based around a town called Tavira, basically on that Algarve strip. And yeah, it was a sort of 3-day stage race where the first day was a kind of city center time trial, so short. You know, it took us about five or six minutes to haul round, and then there was two longer days of, I believe it was 90 kilometers the second day and right. 75 kilometers the third day. Okay,
how does that tie into your main, is that just really a training event for you then?
Yeah, it's a little more of a training event. Obviously, the usual races that I do are about 1.5 hours, you know, pure sort of Olympic distance, Olympic level cross country, where this is still classed in the cross country discipline. You still world ranking points for the cross country side of things.
Yeah.
But they do it. Yeah, it's a little bit more like a marathon, which is a bit interesting with the longer stages.
Yeah.
And I still went there trying to get, you know, the world ranking points and get a good result. But like you said, Colin, it's a bit more of a training race than a regular cross country 1.5 hour race. Yeah.
But you still get points. I kind of assumed there when you said it's like around a town centre and stuff like that, it wouldn't be counted as a cross-country race, so you wouldn't be getting rankings. So that's quite good. At least you get... Is it a UCI event, you said?
It was, yeah. So it's a world-ranked race. There was some, you know, really, really top-class riders there. The guy... There's actually a discipline called Sprint Eliminator, which is kind of they did it in the World Cups for a few years, and they're bringing it back now. And essentially it's a short course, you know, you do multiple heats that lead to a final. And it's usually, you know, a couple of minutes sort of sprint round a condensed cross country course. And the current world champion was there. And so obviously he was going around pretty fast with his partner. That was the kind of, essentially for this stage race, it's more of a sort of spectacle for the local town and the fans to be able to get close to the athletes. And there was a big crowd all the way around the town. It was really sort of narrow cobbled streets. Yeah. And it was at night as well, actually. So we all had lights on, and it was a pretty nice show.
Yeah, that's cool. How does the eliminator aspect of it work then?
Well, this one was obviously just the first stage. It was one sort of loop, and then they take your time, which then dictates the start order for the second day. But usually it's sort of modeled on the sprint eliminator thing, which in the World Cups, it's, you kind of have a big load of athletes. They're split into heats, and then the top two go through, you know, to the quarterfinals, semifinals, etc., up to the finals. It's essentially trying to sort of condense it, make it better for spectators, and with the World Cups and Red Bull filming it, it's obviously quite easy to film with it being a shorter course.
Yeah. So it's a team thing. You're actually racing as a partnership.
Yeah. The sprint eliminator thing that it's kind of modeled on is just an individual thing, but this Algarve bike challenge race that we did was a pairs. So I raced around with a partner. Yeah. So that was quite interesting sometimes when you're not, we were quite evenly, we did a good job of sort of combining our efforts and strengths and weaknesses. We've raced together before. My partner's actually the current national champion in marathon discipline, a guy called Ben. So we had a good opening stage, actually. Cool. Yeah,
that is interesting, isn't it? Like when you race with, I've not done an actual official partnership race before, but I've raced with people. Well, I say race. I mean, I use the word race loosely. Just complete the help each other complete the whole thing. But how? So if you're in a race where you're actually really competing, you're trying to win the thing. How do you sort of assess those strengths and weaknesses and stuff? Like, what were your balance? Like, did you help each other out with stuff?
Yeah, so it's essentially that when the results come out, you both get, you know, you both get the same position kind of thing. So you get the same amount of points and everything. So you have to kind of finish together, etc. But
yeah,
it's just, I think obviously it's good to know what the strengths and weaknesses are before you come to the race rather than kind of finding that out in the actual event. Yes. But for us, typically I'm a lighter weight rider, so generally better on the sort of climbs, longer climbs especially, and Ben is a marathon specialist, so he's really, you know, just consistently fast over a long period of time, and his downhill speed is good as well, so it's you've just got to be, essentially it's all about good communication and just making sure that everyone's, that the other person's okay, and not, you know, you're not distancing each other via those strengths or weaknesses.
So for example, you're quicker up a long sustained hill then. What do you do to, is there something you can do to help him there? Like, are you doing drafting or anything like that in this kind of race? Are you going fast enough for that?
Yeah, exactly. There's some times where the race would pop out. I mean, generally it was all off-road, but the worst sections where it will pop out onto a road for, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, and that's when you can start sort of drafting and using and just setting up, so you put the sort of, you might put actually the weakest person on the front to make sure that the other person's not going too hard and dropping them and that kind of thing. I should point out here actually that I got ill basically just before the race, so it turned out that I wasn't actually that strong on the climbs in that race. I just wasn't strong in general. those team dynamics were a little bit different.
So what you're saying is Ben dragged you around the trail for the whole time.
Ben dragged me around and waited for me a lot in the final sort of half an hour of each of the two longer stages, because I just spectacularly blew up and not pretty.
It happens, eh?
it does and I, you know, Ben was saying to me, you feel quite bad when it's a partner's race and you're the one sort of being the anchor kind of thing, but you know, Ben said he's been in the same situation on the other side of the fence and happens to everyone. It happened to quite a few of the the top runners, you know, some of the other guys that were going for the overall as well. So it's that time of year, and especially when you're sort of traveling internationally and taking flights and all this sort of stuff, there's quite a lot of potential for getting ill.
Do you find it more, there's obviously a different dynamic. Do you find it more fun doing a partner race, or do you just enjoy the solo stuff more?
I would say I don't really enjoy one more than the other. They're definitely different, and it's a nice way to start the season actually, because obviously you kind of share in the triumphs or lack of triumphs. And it's just something different that I'm not typically used to throughout the season. So I do enjoy it. And it's good once you're there at the race, sort of before the race and after the race, warming up together and talking about the race. So there's definitely dynamics and parts of it that are really, really good.
I find it kind of funny actually doing stuff with people, doing races with people, or even training with people. Like, quite a lot of people I know, including my wife actually, goes out with, you know, partners running just to train and stuff. Like, they meet up as a group, and I know there's actually a really good cycling club in my village. It's kind of Dundee based, but in my wee village there's a club called Cog Velo go out all the time, and they go out for rides with like 15-20 people, and they do running clubs as well. But I have to admit, I don't know. I can motivate myself enough, I think, by myself that I just quite enjoy the peace and quiet, and I don't really like the pressure to have to sort of talk to people a little bit in a way around. It kind of feels it's, I don't know, it takes away a bit from the training. You can't quite go at your own limit. You're always either being pushed too hard, in which case you hate it, or you're not being pushed hard enough because you're waiting for somebody else. So I always tend to go at myself. And I actually always appreciate the... because I listen to a lot of podcasts, obviously. And so I listen to, I appreciate like half an hour or an hour to go out and just listen to some stuff and enjoy
it.
And get the training in too. So, but then again, in races, I have really enjoyed races where I've done it with people. Like there was one, we did the Ben Nevis Mountain Triathlon. What did they call it again? The Big Ben Nevis Challenge, I think they called it. It was by No Fuss, and it was an off-road triathlon. So it was about sort of half Ironman times. So it took like the sort of best people maybe 5-6 hours to complete. So it was a big one. And that was good fun because I went around that with a few friends, my brother and a good pal of mine. So that, you know, there's a bit of camaraderie when you're not trying to compete, certainly for me. It was just about completing it. So there was like motivating each other and pushing each other on. So
exactly.
It seems to depend on the context for me, but.
It does. Yeah, I'm the same. I always train on my own, you know, basically 100% of the time.
Really?
If there's like a friend in town, you know, that I know, is on a similar level, then one in 100 times kind of go out with someone else. But I'm exactly the same. I prefer to just have sort of goals that I've sort of set, and then you don't have other people kind of dictating what's going to be done and the pace and that kind of thing. So I always train on my own. And then, like you said, it's when it comes to racing, sometimes having a bit of camaraderie and some banter and stuff and shared experiences is good. And I think if you ride on your own all the time, sometimes you appreciate those little times where you do ride with someone else, you know, maybe a little bit more.
There's definitely motivation. I know that my wife goes out more often when she has them organized, like it's less likely to kind of not do it, I suppose. And I have to admit there's times when I'm trying to train myself and I don't do it because of that, but I don't know. They're both ways sometimes, but
Cool.
No, it was good to get an update though. That sounds like an interesting race. I think I probably spent enough time on it just now on your update and stuff, but it'd be good to speak in the next episode about your plans for the next couple of months, because this is always, we must be coming into the race season now, are we?
We are, I actually just missed the first round of the national series just because of this illness, trying not to dig myself too much into a bigger hole. Tried to be a bit sensible there, but the second round's coming up and we're definitely into the start of the race season.
Perfect. Okay, cool. Well, we'll catch up on that next episode then. I'll ask you what the plans are, what's coming up, and
stuff.
And actually maybe get an idea as well on, I've been curious as well to ask you about how easy it is to get into this as a professional, like to become a professional racer, what sort of it takes, how you define it as well, like, because there must be a lot of people out there like do these series, but they have a proper job as well. That was insulting. Proper job. They have a more traditional job at the same time. It'd be good to get your thoughts on that. So let's do that on the next episode. This time around, I've got a bit of feedback from somebody. Do you remember we talked about single speed racing?
We did,
A while back. And I asked if anybody had any feedback on it, because we didn't really have that much experience with it. We gave a few thoughts on it, but there was a lady called Nancy Kim wrote in. Now, Nancy does a lot of racing herself. I think she writes a fair bit for another site called, let me look it up. What was it called again? I can't remember. Anyway, I'll get that before we finish this up and I'll give it a mention. But Nancy wrote in with an audio clip, which I'll play for you just now.
I have a single speed, but not for any of the reasons mentioned by Colin or Tom. I don't ride a single speed to prove to the world that I can conquer hills without gears, because I can't. I actually need gears. I have a single speed, but it's one of four in my quiver of bikes. It's a Norco 125 dirt jumper, and it has a 2-to-1-ish gear ratio. And I ride it at a popular trail center near Seattle called Do the Hill, where I go mainly to ride the flowy jump trails. So there's not a lot of pedaling involved. I don't have to worry about breaking a derailleur or changing a cassette, which are both pretty expensive propositions on my other bike. I mean, a SRAM GX rear mech is $100 and the cassette's another C-note. For many places I ride, I love my gears, particularly the 42-tooth cog for steep climbs. Again, it's not the only bike that I have, and if I were limited to one bike on a desert island, it wouldn't be a single speed. However, for those of us who believe in quivers, and there's really no such thing as a quiver killer, the single speed is actually a pretty fun and practical aero to have.
Cool. Thanks very much for that, Nancy. It's interesting. Yeah, so Tom, she uses it actually for a really practical reason, which is simplicity when you don't actually need to pedal uphill. That's interesting.
It is, yeah. And it's funny that we've been talking about, you know, making bikes simpler with the one-by system and getting rid of the front derailleur and essentially getting rid of anything that could that's got the potential to have, you know, an issue out on the trail that might be unfixable or expensive to fix. So I hadn't actually thought about that. And it makes a lot of sense now that Nancy's actually brought it to light.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's just neither of us really do that type of riding, is it? So it never really popped up. But there must be, there'll be downhillers out there going, "What the hell are you talking about, you idiots? Of course you do that." Because we don't need to pedal uphill. You just got to lift uphill. And then all you need is one gear, really, which is the gear, you know, the standard gear you would use for accelerating while you're going at high speed already. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. So yeah, anyone out there, if you were listening to that topic, I hope that gave you a bit of help. That's where you would maybe use a single speed in a really practical sense. And thanks again, Nancy. That's really good. If anyone else has any audio comments, I'd love to get more of these. They're brilliant to put in the show, get some new voices in the show. So if you have anything you want to send in, could be a question for Tom or me. It could be a comment based on something we've said already. Could even be a little feature. If you want to send in, say, a short review of a bit of kit that you're using, or a trail that you go around, or maybe a tip of your own, maybe something that you've picked up in terms of skills or equipment or maintenance or anything at all about mountain biking, send me in a clip. Try and keep it short as possible. So if you can keep questions and comments under maybe a couple of minutes, if it's a review or something, you can go a wee bit longer, but still sort of about a 5-minute limit or so, and send that in. I'd love to feature them on the show. Happy to put you in, give you a wee credit. And even if you write for another mountain biking site, that's what I was going to do. Let me check what Nancy wrote for, because I want to make sure that I give people credit, give you, you know, something back at least. So if you are out there, you're interested in mountain biking, Nancy writes for, the article she sent me was for mtbparks.com. So if you go to mtbparks.com, you'll see a lot of Nancy's writing out there. Cool. So yeah, be great if you could send that in. You can obviously send them in to colin@mountainbikesapart.com. An easiest way to do it, pull out your smartphone. You can get your smartphone, voice recorder app, hold it up to your ear as if you're making a phone call and just speak into the phone that way. And it actually makes a pretty decent recording. Alrighty. Right. So actually that leads quite well into the listener question here, Tom, because the question is about that very thing. It's about simplifying your bike. And that leads on from us talking about the 1x11, 3x9, all that kind of gearing systems. So this is from Daniel West, and I'll just read out his question here. So this is what Daniel said. "I just wanted to write in and say how much I love your podcast." Thanks, Daniel. "I'm 15 and race mountain bikes, and you guys have some great tips and pointers. Just wanted to say how great your show is and ask you some questions as well. So I was wondering if it's possible to upgrade my bike's drivetrain without having to buy a completely new setup. I currently have a 3x9 Shimano Dior system, and I've really been wanting a 1x11 for weight reasons and simplicity, but the cost of a whole new drivetrain is a bit much. I've heard it's possible to buy separate gears and add them to your rear cassette, along with a new front chainring. If you know anything about this, help would be appreciated. Thanks, and keep up the good work." Cheers, Daniel. That's a really good question. And certainly not something I've done a whole lot with. I know that you can sort of edit your gears, if that's the right term. You can take things off, put them on. But Tom, what are your thoughts? You done any work around this?
Yeah, I'm just trying to, I mean, I've been on a, you know, one by kind of 11 system for a long time. I'm just trying to think back to when I was in a similar position to Daniel and, you know, editing a sort of more regular traditional setup.
I think
the problems I ran into is that, as sort of Daniel alludes to, is that one thing kind of rolls into the next. So, you know, you get a different chain ring and sometimes they will or won't fit on the crank that you've got. If you manage to do that, then you sometimes need to change the chain because the chain's wider than it needs to be. And if you can, then if you get away with that, you get away with keeping the chain. The cassette at the back, sometimes when you've got a one by system, a 9-speed at the back isn't going to be enough spread of gears. So sometimes it's then about going to a 10-speed or 11-speed, which then affects the chain and the derailleur. And they've done quite a good job of, you know, systems integration and
making it hard,
making it difficult, making it expensive.
I mean, go on, you finish first.
I was just going to say it depends obviously on the terrain that Daniel or someone or whoever's riding. If you're in a sort of fairly flat area and you don't need a massive spread of gears at the back, you might be able to just keep your existing cassette and existing derailleur and then just put a single ring on the front, you know, a chain retaining ring on the front, and maybe that would be enough to get away with it.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask, actually. A couple of things there. First of all, chain width, you have to change your chain width. So it's a different chain once you move up from, is it from 9 to 10 or 10 to 11? Do you remember?
Sometimes a 9-speed chain will work with 10-speed potentially. Yeah.
That's what I thought. So 9 and 10 are the same, is that right? But then if you go to 11, that's a narrower one, isn't it? They changed
you can obviously get dedicated 10-speed chains that are narrower. And actually you could run an 11-speed chain on a 9-speed
because it's narrower, but sometimes
the chain is just going to be too thick with the reduced space between the cogs.
Certainly from a 9 to an 11. So if you're running a 9 just now, it's likely you've got quite a wide chain, or the standard size chain, I should say, and that wouldn't work very well in 11, will it? So that was the first thing. Next one was the chain jumping, wasn't it? Because the first thing that occurs to me is that I know that you can remove rings from the crank. So you've got your 3 chain rings in the front. You can, it's not that hard actually to take a couple of chain rings off because it's just a couple of retaining bolts, isn't it?
Exactly.
So you could try it out, couldn't you, by just putting a single ring in the front and just having your front derailleur almost, you take it off, you can set the limits. Well, actually, I was going to either take it off or keep it on, but set the limiters so that it keeps the chain in the right place. So it actually acts as a chain retention device.
Yeah.
So your front derailleur could do that. The reason to do that, I would have said, is that the front chain rings are designed when you've got 3 to actually throw the chain off, aren't they? Sometimes, anyway, because that's what lets you change your gears. So actually, it's not perfect if you've only got one in the front to keep an old school, part of 3 chain ring, because the new single chain rings in the front are designed to really keep the chain on, aren't they?
They are, exactly, yeah.
So they prevent chain jumping. So it is possible, Daniel. Certainly you could try it out. It's something that you could, if you want to just test it out, see if it's really worth it for you, you could take off a couple of the front chain rings, use a derailleur as a retention device. Do you think you can add an extra ring or two to a derailleur? I wouldn't have thought you can do that, to be honest. I've never seen anyone do that.
To the rear cassette.
Sorry, that's what I meant, the rear cassette,
Yeah. I've seemed to remember seeing that you could get a sort of the largest cog at the back and as a single and add that. But I would imagine there's some compatibility issues when it only works with certain cassettes and that kind of thing. And one other thing as well, Colin, that kind of popped into my head is the fact that, generally speaking, when you've got a one by system, you'll need some sort of clutch system on the rear derailleur, which tightens the sort of cage spring. So when you're riding along with a regular rear mech, your cage, the bit that kind of hangs down that holds the jockey wheels, is moving fore and aft quite a lot. And with the dedicated kind of one by rear derailleurs from Shimano and SRAM.
They've got a
sort of switch on there that really stops that cage moving around, because when the cage moves forward, it obviously gives a lot of slack to the chain, which then can bring it off the ring at the front. So I have heard of people using the rear derailleur, you know, a regular rear derailleur without a clutch system, and it being okay. But from personal experience, I've always found that if I've forgotten to switch the clutch on, the chain will kind of has definitely more of a tendency to come off, even though it's a sort of retaining ring on the front. There's I can see why so many people, you know, have questions about this sort of switch, because there's quite a lot of components to it.
And I hadn't even thought, it hadn't even occurred to me yet that he needs a new shifter. So Daniel, you'll need obviously an 11 speed shifter or a 10 speed shifter or whatever on the front, if you're adding an extra one or two cogs to your cassette. So actually there's a cost there too. And the thing that occurs to me is that I bought my upgrade kit as a package. And so I got everything. I got the shifter, the cassette, the cranks, all that stuff. And I looked into it separately. I looked into upgrading bits at a time, because one thing you can think about is actually upgrading it part at a time as it wears out, because you should, I mean, if you're doing a lot of riding, you'll be replacing your cassette every year or so anyway. You'll be replacing your cranks every year or so too. So you're going to be upgrading this stuff over time anyway. So that's an opportunity. You would have to be spending that money in any case, so you can upgrade it to 11 speed bit by bit. But I looked at that and I discovered that you buy it as a package. And if you're not in a rush, you keep an eye on the main four or five bike shops, you'll find an 11-speed package at like a 50% discount at some point.
Yeah.
Like the package, the bundle itself already gives you a discount on buying it all separately. So the full price bundle is like maybe 10, 20% off the full price of all the things separately. But I got mine, I think it was almost 50% off. So it was way cheaper than buying. I think I ended up getting my whole kit for, I think it was just 270, 280, I believe, for the whole thing. And the RRP for it was something like 600. And if I bought it all separately, it would have been about that cost as well. So if you're going to end up buying these extra cogs, you're going to end up buying an extra shifter, that's going to be probably over £100 anyway, with a new chain and stuff like that as well. So it might well be worth not doing the bodge, Daniel, because you're going to end up with something that is just a bit not great. It's going to be jumping around, it's going to be loose, it's going to have problems, it's going to annoy you out in the trail. Maybe best to actually just do a bit of saving over the next 6 months, save up enough and just keep an eye out for those discounts.
Good tip.
Okay, any final feedback on that, Tom? Anything I just said? Or
no, I think that's a great tip, actually. And I've definitely seen, as I've been sort of noodling around on bike shop websites, that group sets, you know, full group sets like you were talking about, Colin, are just, they probably, I imagine they probably don't sell in high volume. So you do see them all the time. You see these huge discounts. So when you start realizing how much money they are actually making on the individual components.
Indeed.
As well.
Yeah. Especially if you're looking at last season. So now there has been a season or two of, you know, 11 speed being quite common. So actually there's a lot of older season stuff now coming up, and that's what the bike shops sell off cheap as chips. So look out for an old kit from last year. And
yeah, 10 speed or something like that.
Or like even an 11 speed from like 2016 or something. They'll be coming up cheap now, I bet. So yeah, keep an eye out. Okay, cool. I hope that helped anyway, Daniel. So thanks for sending the question. Again, anyone, if you have a question, send it in to colin@mountainbikesapart.com by email, or on the contact form on the website. If you go to mountainbikesapart.com, you'll find the contact form there, or tweet it if it's a short one. Just send it to @thepodcasthost is my handle. And you are, Tom?
It's on Twitter.
Yes, indeed.
That's by Tom Bell. So BYTOMBELL.
By Tom Bell. Cool. Ask us either of us a question on Twitter, and we'll put that into, we'll answer you on Twitter, but we'll also put it into a future show as well. All right. I think that'll do it for this episode. That was episode 6 of season 3 of the Mountain Bikes Apart podcast. Thanks again for joining me, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. It's good to have a catch up.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about your upcoming month, actually, and a bit about how you kind of transitioned into being a pro as well. I think that'll be interesting.
Indeed. Yeah, cool.
Cool. If you're out there, you want to learn more about this, anything we've mentioned on the show, a summary of the show and everything, you can go to the show notes, which you can find at mountainbikesapart.com/306. So that's season 306 for the episode 306. mountainbikespart.com/306. Cool. Thanks again for joining me. Always appreciate your time. I know it's precious. So hopefully see you next time around. Have a good week and we'll talk to you then.
See you soon.